The Snake River Killer podcast is tracking multiple active and cold cases. This investigation is happening in real time. All individuals named and unnamed in this podcast are innocent until proven guilty by a court of law. This episode contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Where is Christina White?
Who is the suspect?
Detective Jackie Nichols believes there may be a connection between Christina White's disappearance, the murders of Christina Nelson and Brandy Miller, as well as the disappearance of Stephen Pearsall.
All suspected to have fallen victim at the hands of another. Law enforcement made a critical discovery shortly after the murders of Miller and Nelson.
The man that was working in the theater that night lived at the home where Christina White disappeared from.
He was very odd himself. He was more creepy, scary odd.
Opposed to the drawdown, so I agree with that, being suspicious.
She was on the porch and she waved goodbye, and that was the last time I saw her.
Before I jump into this episode, there are several updates that I want to make you aware of, as there is a lot happening behind the scenes of this show. First, as I mentioned in the previous episode, listeners heard, a listener and friend of mine and licensed drone pilot Brandon Chapman has agreed to lend his services this spring to check a few areas of interest connected to these cases. That is something I'm very much looking forward to. Also, we will try to coordinate these drone flights with Gloria and a friend of hers, Florence, who is an anthropologist. Both Gloria and Florence also have cadaver dogs, so stay tuned on that front. Second, I'm excited to announce that Dr. Marianne White, whose PhD is in criminology, has joined the Snake River podcast team. Dr. White, no relation to Christina White, actually wrote her doctoral dissertation on serial killers. So what she has to say as we move along through these cases is going to be critical, and I can't wait to bring her on the show in subsequent episodes. Third, the current owner of the Dome Homes has declined our request to tour the structures. And while I'm obviously disappointed that I won't get a chance to see the den or have a cadaver dog check the living room, I totally get it, and I want to respect the owner's privacy. Fourth, remember the Afghan Bitch classified ad? Well, I was recently speaking with our team member Samantha Sawyer about this ad, and a couple of things boiled up out of that conversation. First, recall that the ad read, quote, Afghan bitch, 3 years old. Well, it had been exactly 3 years since Christina White's disappearance, so that's one thing that could mean something, or maybe not. The other thing was something Sam brought up, and that was this business about the spaying fee. It seems like for whomever wrote the ad, spaying the dog was a foregone conclusion. My rudimentary understanding of Afghan hounds is that while they are primarily show dogs now, in the 70s and 80s, they were very popular and known to be something of status symbol dogs, as in, they are a kind of dog you might want to breed. I've read some articles that say spaying Afghan hounds can cause their coats to change for the worst, and so the practice ought to be avoided. However, in other articles, I've read that spaying Afghan hounds protects them from certain cancers and, more obviously, prevents unwanted puppies. So, I'm not sure how to weigh that part. Maybe someone listening knows more about these dogs than I do and can shed some light on the question. If so, please reach out. Finally, I want to circle back to the tooth Tamara and Ryan found on the Snake River last summer. If you didn't listen to the special episode of Listeners Heard, you should. But for now, you should know that last summer, Tamara and Ryan, LC Valley residents, found what appears to have been a human tooth on the banks of the Snake River. The tooth was a full tooth, roots and all. Also, you should know that it was found upriver from Assotin, Washington, the very town from which Christina White disappeared. Concerned that it was in fact a human tooth, and that it could very well have come from a child, Tamara and Ryan turned it into the Nez Perce County Sheriff. Now, when Tamara and Ryan were explaining to me where they found it, they had mentioned that it was about a half a mile to three quarters of a mile upriver from Redbird Beach. Directionally, that would be south. A few days after my conversation with them, I was suddenly reminded of an article I had read and had mentioned on episode 1 as it pertained to the Christina White case. A psychic named Addie Alderman from North Central Idaho had contacted authorities in Asotin just days after Christina's disappearance. She let them know that she had a vision and had seen Christina White's body in the Snake River. Specifically, she said the body was, quote, about 1 mile south of Redbird Beach on the Idaho side of the river, end quote. That was the exact same place and side of the river where Tamara and Ryan found the tooth. Now listen, I don't know how I really feel about psychics, to be honest. My hunch is that a lot of them are probably charlatans. On the other hand, some police departments do, in fact, engage psychics or mediums like Fiona Johansson, for instance, who has been quite successful in that regard. So there is that. Anyway, I just find that overlap of the tooth's location and Addie Alderman's vision to be eerily coincidental. Ultimately, however, I needed to get to the bottom of whether or not this tooth was human or animal. So I reached out to Dr. Larry Parker, who happens to be a close friend and who has a dental practice in Minnesota.
Hey, Brandon.
Hey, Larry, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing well. So one of the first things we started talking about before you saw the picture of the tooth was whether or not human teeth can have 3 roots, right?
Correct.
And you said that, yes, they can. You've seen upper molars with 3, even 4. So then when you saw the tooth, you were like, that's not really a human tooth. That's kind of what you were communicating to me. Can you tell me how you arrived at that conclusion for the listeners?
Sure. So for a dentist, it's obviously not, my first thought is it's obviously not a permanent first molar, because the roots are not long enough, and the cemento enamel junction where the enamel meets the roots, it's too bulbous, so it's not a permanent tooth. So my next thought was maybe it's a baby tooth, but for it to be a baby tooth, it, I don't want to get too technical, but the cusps, which are the points on the teeth, mm-hmm. are too pointy to be a human tooth. The roots are too splayed to be human roots. So that's about the best I can tell you without giving you pictures of human ones with some other examples. Now, I did go and post this picture on one of my dental Facebook groups, and to a person they said, no, it's not a human tooth. Most people said it was a canine tooth, canine being dog, not canine as in type of human tooth.
Right.
And there was another guy that said maybe that it was a raccoon tooth, but
okay,
it's unfortunately it is not human. I wish it was.
Yeah, because that could have been, you know, potentially big. I mean, of course, a lot of people die on the Snake River and that kind of thing. But so you had mentioned maybe running it by an anthropologist, but it's from what I'm hearing, what you said, and you put it out to a few other experts, that it's, I mean, you're probably 95 to 100% sure it's not human tooth.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 95% would be an out there. I would say you're a lot closer to 100% that it's not human.
Okay, okay. You had also mentioned to me, when you messaged, that it's probably not that old of a tooth.
Right. Just because I would expect, with it being in the weather and in the water, I would expect to see at least the root surfaces have pits in them, mm-hmm. some type of pitting from either the turbulence of the water or just the natural breakdown of tooth structure.
Right.
The enamel wouldn't show any pitting, but I would expect the roots to not be that smooth. So it looks like it hadn't been out there very long, maybe not more than a year. So yeah, that's what I think.
Okay. Well, that's really helpful. And it's good to know from an expert that it looks like I can pretty much rule it out and focus on other things in the case.
Yeah, I wouldn't go looking for this to be anything to do with your missing people, unfortunately.
So as disappointed as I am that the tooth is almost certainly an animal tooth, the Nez Perce Sheriff's Office reached the same conclusion, as it happens. I am still compelled to get a drone into that reach of the river, if for no other reason than to cross it off the list of areas of interest. For now, though, I want to turn back to the Civic Theater 3 cases, because there are still so many moving parts and so many angles to consider. So in episode 5, remember how I sort of ran a hypothetical clock on Lance's movements at the Civic Theater on the night of September 12, 1982? And recall how he told the police that he left the Red Baron Pizzeria at 11 p.m. when the movie The Fog had ended. Well, this version of his story came up when I was talking with Gloria recently, but what she has to say puts a whole different spin on his original story.
I was looking here on my notes. In Lance's second interview, he does change his timeline. He said that he got back to the theater around 11:30.
So, two things about that detail. First, his story is changing, so that should be a red flag. But second, if he left the Red Baron at 11:30, then there is absolutely no way he could have been in a deep sleep 30 minutes later when Stephen came through the door. Even if we generously trim his timeline down and give him 2 minutes to drive from the Red Baron to the Civic and only 15 minutes to work on a set, 1 minute to move his car, 2 more minutes to go into the loft and fall, an additional 2 minutes to make his way back to the green room. That means he would only been asleep for 8 minutes when Stephen got back. I also want to mention something here that I hadn't dug into in the previous episode as it relates to his story and purported timeline, and that is the physiology both of sleep and adrenaline. The stages of human sleep are well documented. Stage 1, for instance, falls into the category of non-REM sleep or non-rapid eye movement sleep. This stage is the dozing off stage, if you will, and typically lasts from 1 to 7 minutes, up to 10 minutes at the very max, under normal sleeping conditions. One of the key physiological changes that takes place during this phase is the slowing of one's heart rate and breathing. In stage 1 of non-REM sleep, individuals are easily awakened by environmental or ambient noises or intrusions, and it is in this stage that Lance would have been in if we are to take him at his word. Moreover, even if we really try to give him the benefit of the doubt and say his stage 1 non-REM sleep cycle lasted only 1 minute, that means the rest of his 7 minutes of sleep before Stephen arrived would occur in stage 2 non-REM, which is light sleep, where noises are a little less likely to wake someone. But there are a few factors you need to bear in mind. As mentioned, these stages apply to normal sleeping conditions. At home, in a routine, in one's own bed, with no ailments, aches, or pains. But with Lance, he claims to have fallen and hurt his finger, possibly his back. We also know that he has a history of leg pain from a motorcycle wreck in California, and we know from his version of the story that he just sprawled out on the couch in the theater basement and dozed off. So, not normal sleeping conditions at all. In fact, the conditions under which he claims to have dozed off are suboptimal at best. Plus, he's not at home in his own bed, but on a couch, and probably not a very comfortable couch, I'm guessing. He's injured, and he has a case of the shakes. Physiologically, it can take 20 to 30 minutes, even longer, for the shakes or adrenaline to wear off, depending on the level of adrenaline one's body produced in response to the triggering stimuli. And an obvious sign of an adrenaline rush is the rapid increase of one's heart rate. In other words, it's going to take a lot longer than 1 minute for an adrenalized heart to slow down enough to even approach stage 1 of non-REM sleep. Even if we were generous and said that his medium case of the shakes would have worn off in 10 minutes and not 20 to 30, and if we stipulated that he remained in stage 1 non-REM sleep for 3 minutes and not, say, 7 to 10, that means he would have just entered stage 1 sleep at the exact moment Stephen entered the Civic Theater into the very room Lance was allegedly in such a deep sleep that he didn't even hear Stephen come in. Also, you can apply the physiology of sleep and adrenaline to his previous timeline, and it still makes his story completely implausible. Leaving Lance's dubious and shifting story behind for the time being, I want to go back to the day after the disappearances of Stephen, Christina, and Brandy. Recall in episode 5 how Christina's boyfriend, Bill, had planned on swinging by her apartment the night of the 12th, but how he fell asleep at his place instead? Well, when he did come by the following morning, he found a note on the door to her apartment that read, "Bill, went to the store, be right back." He also noticed a couple of other things. One, the morning paper had arrived and the mail was jammed in the door. So this is Monday morning, September 13th. But when Bill read the note on the door, he thought it had been written that very morning, not the previous day. And when he stepped into the apartment, he noticed a few other things. First, the lights were on, indicating to him, again, that Christina had just stepped out. Second, he noticed Tigger, Christina's cat, prowling around, and he noticed, too, that the pump motor on the fish tank was running. Inside, he found a second note that read, "Bill, be right back. Just took my laundry down the street. Come on in. Have a seat. Chris." As far as I can tell, Christina would have placed that second note, the one about the laundry, on her door the previous day after her 8:30 p.m. phone call with Bill, but before she went to Safeway. You should know here that I have been in touch with Bill, who has been following the podcast, but who does not want to be on the show. But because some of the newspaper accounts surrounding the note on the door and about going to Safeway and about the note about going to do laundry were confusing, at least to me, I wanted to get some clarity, which he provided and for which I am thankful. And also along these lines, when I tried to reach out to Stephen's girlfriend, Carol, I learned sadly that she had passed away several years ago. Because Bill had to go to work, he left his own note in the apartment apprising Christina of his plans that day. Later that night, at around 10:30, Bill returned to the apartment only to discover that nothing had changed. No one, it appeared, had been there except for him. On account of it being late, Bill turned in for the night. But when he woke up at 2 a.m., Christina still wasn't home. And that is when he began to worry. The following morning, Bill got on the phone, ringing up all of her friends, contacts, classmates, acquaintances, coworkers, anyone who might know where she was. But he came up empty-handed. Going off the two notes, Bill checked the apartment building where Christina did her laundry, and there was no sign of her there. He then checked the store. Again, no trace. Knowing that Christina had to be at work that evening at the Skipper Seafood Restaurant, he stopped in during what would have been her scheduled shift, only to find out she no-showed. That was something utterly out of character for Christina. And that is when Bill knew his next stop had to be the police. So, on Tuesday, September 14th at 6:45 p.m., Bill reported Christina Nelson and Brandy Miller missing with the Lewiston Police Department. Meanwhile, across town, Carol had been trying to get a hold of her boyfriend, Stephen Pearsall. She hadn't seen him since she dropped him off at the Civic Theater at about midnight on Sunday, September 12th. Like Bill, Carol would have phoned all of Stephen's friends, classmates, coworkers, and family. Because she also worked at TJ's Pantry, she would have checked in with the management there as well. In fact, a coworker of theirs named Clint Maxey, not to be confused with Clint, Lance's stepson, also became alarmed when Stephen didn't show up for his shift Tuesday night at TJ's Pantry. Maxey later told reporters that not showing up for work, quote, didn't fit his character, end quote. He further stated that Stephen, quote, wasn't the kind of person to just go missing. He's as regular as clockwork, end quote. Distressed, Carol called the police at 11:30 Tuesday night and officially reported Stephen missing. Clint Maxey also reported Stephen missing the same night. So three young people, three young creative individuals all vanish on the same night in small town America. As it happens, I was down in the LC Valley on the 40th anniversary of their disappearances, September 12, 2022. Gloria was also in the valley, and we had planned on meeting up at the Civic Theater that night, but for a variety of reasons, we weren't able to connect, although we later learned that we had both been in the same restaurant at the same time, but didn't see one another. Anyway, I wanted to put myself at the Civic at about the time Carol picked up Stephen and when Lance said he had gone to the Red Baron. The weather that night was quite warm, much warmer than it was 40 years earlier, but the air was filled with smoke from wildfires blazing in Oregon, making the valley look shrouded in fog. This is September 12th, 2022, which is the 40-year anniversary of the Civic 3 murders. And I'm back at the Civic Theater, and I'm back at the back entrance. It's the night of, it's dark now. And I can't tell you how eerie this is. For one thing, the wildfires right now have put off so much smoke that the valley is just, it's like a London fog. It's just misty and ethereal and kind of creepy. and I'm at the back of the theater. And I don't think I saw this last time I was here, but there is a bunch of like garbage back here, piled like random stuff, like a blanket. There's like weird stuff in the window too. Like, what the hell is that? Like sticks? It looks like there's like a shrine of some sort here, like an effigy of some sort. This is crazy. This was not here last time I was here, back in the spring. It looks deliberate. So there's chain link around this place because they're tearing it down, which is kind of a shame. It's one of those things. It's sort of like the Elsey Valley itself. It's like beautiful and haunted. So I'm now in front of the Civic Theater. Again, chain link around it. It's totally dark. Totally haunting, to be honest. This place is a ruin. 40 years ago tonight, Lance was here claiming to work on sets for a play. He said he went down to the Red Baron pizza joint, which is this, literally you take that path behind the Civic Theater and you go down to the valley floor, and about a half a block there's a pizza joint, the Red Baron. He said he was there for a while. This is depressing, I gotta tell you. This is like almost mid-September. It's right at the beginning of a new college season. It's when students should be excited and happy and engaged and not afraid of losing their lives. But this is definitely weird. What if I tried the door? It's definitely locked. No getting in. I'm gonna probably get the cops called on me at this point. But this stuff back here, this garbage that I talked about earlier, like the weird effigy. What the hell is going on here?
When I think back on all of that clutter and debris behind the Civic Theater, it occurs to me now that much of that litter was probably the leavings of a homeless person or persons. But the strange effigy stick arrangements that are sort of Blair Witch-esque calls to mind something Clint had mentioned to both me and to Paul, something he says he heard in the days or weeks after the disappearances.
Well, there are a few different things that kind of jumped out at me, sort of surrounding the whole story. And some of it does come from Clint and his memories, his recollection, which do seem very clear in some details. And then others, he doesn't seem as clear and almost seems to contradict himself. But I can't help but coming back to the story about, and I know we don't have much information on this yet. I did reach out and spoke with a very nice woman at the theater today who said she'd pass my name along to Fred. She knew how to get in touch with him.
Okay, good. So we maybe have a path in that direction, because I know that contacting Fred Scheibe has been a little bit challenging.
It has. And you know, now we're getting to someone who's in his 80s, but I'd really love to ask about these cloaked figures that were in the theater that Fred came upon, apparently, and with the police, Clint says.
Yeah, can you just pause there for a minute and kind of explain what you know about this weird incident?
The very first detail is one of those examples of where, for all of his precise recollections, Clint was fuzzy. One point in our interview, he said it was before Stephen was reported missing, and then later he said that he certainly remembered that it was after they had found his paycheck and that he had been reported missing. So the timeline was fuzzy. He said he didn't know if Fred outright said it or if someone else mentioned it, but then later he says that he remembers Fred looking petrified and shaking as he told Lance and him this story. It was after hours. There were, the way Clint described it, he said a scary group with a cultish-like feel to them. I think he used the words cloaked. They were dressed all in black or some sort of costume. Fred saw something going on, and then he apparently went in with the police. There were no break-ins. There was no evidence of a break-in. But the interesting detail that he said that, you know, again, we haven't confirmed at this point with Fred or with the police, is that the back door was standing open. And this is the same back door that you talked to Dave about, and Dave said nobody had a key to that. He only remembered opening it from one side. Clint said something about how they didn't want the janitor going through the side door, which cut through the lobby. So there was this back door that Dave said he didn't think anybody had a key to. He didn't even remember it ever being open, maybe once from the inside. This is the door that Clint said was standing open, but there was no sign of a break-in. And he said that Stephen was the one who had the key to that back door at the time. So putting two and two together, it could be connected that this group, whoever they were, had the key somehow that belonged to Stephen, who was, depending on the story, either not reported missing at the time or they had just found his paycheck. And then Clint went on to say that a lot of the details about this cult activity going on, so now we're talking early 80s.
Right.
A lot of those details about, you know, these cults like to break into churches, they like to hang the cross upside down, they like to do all of their nefarious activities in these churches. And this sort of sidebar information was all given to him from Lance. And Clint's only explanation was that, you know, Lance must have studied these things.
Ultimately, this narrative about these alleged hooded figures in the Civic Theater was injected into these cases by Lance via Clint. And it is a narrative that I find, frankly, unbelievable for all of the reasons I've mentioned in previous episodes. So why does this trope keep coming up in these cases? Put simply, it's a red herring. It's a distraction, something to obfuscate or cloud investigators' focus and our attention, which is why I hesitate to even bring it up again. But this particular story is coming ultimately from the man who is the sole person of interest in these cases. In other words, it is good to remind ourselves how we ought to pay more attention to the messenger than to the message. So what to make of those odd stick figure effigies at the Civic Theater? Honestly, I don't know. More than likely, it's the handiwork of bored teenagers and has nothing to do with the cases, but I did find them odd and worthy of comment. So pushing all of this extraneous noise aside, I want to come back to something that has been bothering me. And it's the question of whether or not Brandy and Christina ever made it to Safeway the night of September 12th, 1982. And it is something that came up recently when I was talking with Sam Sawyer, our graphic designer and researcher.
So one of the things that I wanted to talk about is something you and I had discussed, and that was, did Brandy and Christina actually make it to Safeway? If they did they buy groceries? And then if they did, what became of those? So I was thinking a little bit more about that, because in episode 5, I said something to the effect of, it remains unclear if they had made it to the store or not. I've been thinking about it a little bit more closely, and I think they had to have made it to the store. And I'll say why. Because A, Safeway was closing at 10 o'clock, and they were leaving somewhere between 9 and 9:30-ish, somewhere in there. And they're on foot. And two, Christina's expecting her boyfriend Bill to be swinging by. She left a note on the door, went to the store, be right back. So she's kind of in a hurry, right?
Yeah.
So I don't think that Lance would have intercepted them prior to the store and said, hey, come up to the theater with me. Because they'd be like, no, we got to get to the store before it closes. And my boyfriend Bill is waiting for me. You had an interesting perspective, and it kind of plays into this, what Dave Blazkowicz was saying, like Lance often portrayed himself as the chivalrous guy, right?
Right, yeah.
So kind of explain how that part of his persona might have played out in this scenario.
Right, so I live right next door to the grocery store, and there's often times where I will walk over and think, you know, I'm just going to go grab a gallon of milk, or I'm just going to go grab one thing. And as I'm in the grocery store, you know, I see that things are on sale. I grab more than I intended to. And then I end up walking with an armful of groceries. And so I just thought, maybe what if that was the case with Brandy and Christina, or something similar, in where Lance was able to use that chivalrous side of him and maybe offer them a ride home to, you know, help, like, hey, those groceries look really heavy, let me help you here. I was thinking kind of after our conversation too, I don't know what the weather is like at that time, but maybe it was starting to rain or get chilly. You know, he could have used that as an excuse too. You know, you look cold, hop in, I'll give you a ride.
It was cooler that night. It was in the 50s, which was somewhat unusual because it had been raining for the previous day or two. They were both wearing jackets, or like a poncho style coat. It was chilly. So that could have been part of it. So Christina would have recognized Lance from being around the theater. So he wasn't, like I said, just kind of a rando in his gold Camaro cruising around. And so she probably felt safe enough to go, you know, I'm in a hurry. It's a steep walk. So, and I was just down there today. So from Safeway up, it's very much up a very steep hill. Mm-hmm. So, you know, lugging groceries when you're in a hurry and it's late at night, you could see how they might have been tempted to get in somebody's car.
Yeah.
So that was one thing that occurred to me. So I am almost certain that they would have gone to the store and come out. And it kind of matches my theory that he probably saw them walk into the store and started thinking on whatever. I mean, allegedly, right? This is all speculative, and he hasn't been charged with the crime. But one could imagine that he saw them going to the store, and then while they're shopping, slowly kind of put this plan together. The question then is, what became of the groceries?
Right. Yeah. I was thinking if the groceries, or potentially even, you know, the receipt from their grocery transaction. You know, I talked to my mom and she said, oh, well, back then we would have used cash. And I was like, well, you guys still would have had receipts. And she was like, well, maybe, maybe not. But if there was a receipt, where is that receipt? And could he have potentially kept that? And that was his trophy from that evening.
So the groceries, the receipt, like the girls, like Stephen Pearsall, and his duffel bag of laundry were gone. They were here on Sunday and gone on Monday. And at the time, that's all people knew. They were just that, missing persons cases, not murder. And Lance hadn't really entered the picture as a person of interest. Police were baffled at the time and hadn't yet connected the Civic Theater 3, directly or otherwise, to either Kristen David's murder or the disappearance of Christina White. Nor was Stephen's disappearance directly linked to Christina and Brandy's disappearances at the time. Willie Russell, who was a sergeant with the Lewiston Police Department, told reporters, quote, there are really only two thoughts, that they just decided to drop out, or you always have to suspect foul play, even though there is no indication to lead you in either direction, end quote. He then added, quote, it just doesn't make sense for foul play with three people at one time, but like I said, you can't rule out anything, end quote. As community pressure mounted, and as family members were demanding answers, police released very little information. One piece of information they did release entailed Christina Nelson's laundry. From another article, we get this. Quote, Nelson reportedly had left her laundry at an apartment complex laundry room where she used to live, near her present apartment. The laundry was seen by a neighbor after she was reported missing, but it was gone when police went to claim it. Police would like to know who picked it up. End quote. Sergeant Don Scheffler, who was also working the cases, added how he wanted to know more about the laundry, stating, quote, even if someone threw it away, if they would just give us a call, they don't even have to leave their name or anything, end quote. But outside of these small bits of information, the police were relatively silent. Scheffler said that they weren't silent for any investigative reason. Quote, we just don't have anything, end quote. Meanwhile, family members were left to grapple with the unimaginable, the unanswered questions, the total emptiness in their lives where a loved one had once resided, that cold and sudden break in the daily mundane assurances that their loved ones would simply be there the next day and the next, as sure as clouds travel the skies. By February of 1983, Stephen, Christina, and Brandy had been missing for 5 months with no leads in sight. Straddling that line between hope and resignation, Christina's father told reporters, quote, "There is so little or nothing you can do. If there really was something that could have been done, it already would have been done," end quote. He then added, quote, "I don't know how to start or where to start," end quote. Stephen Pearsall's father said, quote, "I am still under the belief, though I have no proof, that Stephen was abducted by a cult," end quote. Stephen's father added how there are secret cults in remote locations where contact with the outside world is restricted. Stephen, he said, may have been forcibly taken by one of these cults. He later added that, quote, "The indications are that he was surprised, taken on the spur of the moment, without a chance to think about it or anything. It's hard to accept that they could have been taken away to some remote place and done away with," end quote. Stephen's father's theory not only tracks with the prevailing thinking of the day regarding cults, but I can see how, if I were in his shoes back then in 1983, it would be a lot easier to deal with my son's disappearance if I thought he had been snatched up by a mountain cult, because that would indicate at least he was still alive and would at least give me some measure of hope. Christina's father was still walking the road of unknowns. "In my case or anybody's case," he said, "I don't know whether to be afraid or alarmed or what to think," end quote. Pearsall's co-worker at TJ's Pantry, Clint Maxey, also believed Stephen was abducted. Whatever happened, he said, was beyond his control. He wasn't the kind to just drop out. March 19th, 1984 was a Monday. Weather in the valley was warm and spring-like, windy with a slight chance of showers. But north of the valley, near the tiny timber town of Kendrick, Idaho, a wiry, dark-haired 16-year-old boy named Marvin Mead was walking along Highway 3 about 2.5 miles north of Kendrick proper, searching for aluminum cans. It was about 3:30 in the afternoon, and he was trekking along the edge of the highway's steep embankment when one of that spring day's gusty winds blew his hat off, sending it wheeling down the rocky slope. Marvin skittered down the hillside after his hat, crabbing over boulders and negotiating footholds among the craggy terrain. He was about 60 feet down from the edge of the highway when he saw something. Bones. But these weren't like the many animal bones Marvin had no doubt seen growing up in that tangled reach of Idaho timberland, where the skulls of squirrels or the hooves of ungulates or even the baskets of mammalian ribcages weren't uncommon finds in the underbrush. No, the thing that set these bones apart was both immediate and terrifying. These bones weren't animal bones, Marvin knew, because animals didn't wear clothing. No doubt alarmed by the discovery, Marvin did what a lot of teenage boys in small-town Idaho would have done. He scrambled back up the embankment and booked it to town to tell his friends, and in this case, those friends were two kids named David and Tony. And like many small-town boys, David and Tony didn't believe Marvin, thought he'd made it up, because as David later said, quote, "When someone tells you they found a body, you don't believe it," end quote. That kind of stuff, in other words, only happened on television and in movies like Stand By Me. But Marvin's discovery was all too real. When they shuffled back down the embankment, the three boys found a skull about 5 yards from the rest of the remains, and more alarming still is that they found a second skull and body partly beneath the remains of the first, according to local reporting. The bodies the boys deduced appeared to be women, based on the clothing. Reporters noted how one of them wore bright-colored pants and both wore women-styled jackets. A dress or knee-length coat was visible, and a knitted scarf was also present. The boys then did what anyone should do in such a case. They alerted authorities, in this case the Latah County Sheriff, Lon Odenborg. Authorities arrived on the scene just after 4 p.m. and initiated a grid search, while Odenborg reached out to a pathologist in San Francisco to come out to Moscow, the county seat, to help identify the bodies. He did not contact the Lewiston Police Department. In fact, the Lewiston Police Department didn't even hear about the bodies until 10 a.m. the following day, when a reporter from a local television station called the department asking for a statement. Why Odenborg failed to alert the Lewiston authorities is unclear, but what is clear is that his misstep incensed Lewiston's commanding officers. Quote, "We are concerned we weren't notified earlier," said Chief Rodney H. Fredrickson, adding, quote, "We'd like to have aided with the investigation," end quote. Captain M.D. Ayler echoed the chief's frustration, stating, It's puzzling why we were left out, end quote. The rest of the LC Valley learned of the discovery on Wednesday, March 21st, from the Lewiston Morning Tribune, which rightly ran the story on page one. And what is an eerie coincidence, it was on that same day, Wednesday, March 21st, 1984, that near the Seattle-Tacoma airport, the remains of the 15th body were found connected to what authorities were then calling the Green River Killer. Meanwhile, the LC Valley and the families connected to the Civic Theater 3 cases were waiting for the positive identification of the bodies, which took over a week. And the results were exactly what the Lewiston Police Department had suspected all along. The bodies were those of Christina Nelson and Brandy Miller. At that point, law enforcement were facing the million-dollar question. Where was Stephen Pearsall? And of course, that question still remains. What wasn't discussed at the time but has since come to light is how authorities found cording with the bodies, as in something akin to laundry cording, suggesting potential strangulation. Last summer, I drove out to the site where the bodies were found, just to get a lay of the land. So I'm at the site where the bodies of Christina Nelson and Brandy Miller were found. And it's a beautiful day, you know, summer day. Blue sky, a few wispy clouds. It's quiet. I guess I would be compelled to say that it's eerie to think that their bodies were just dumped here. And I would be right to say that it's eerie, but beyond eerie, I don't know. I just feel this huge, crushing sadness. I don't know why. You can only look at murder so long before it starts to wear on you, I think. And I think it's wearing on me. So I guess I'm wondering, why am I doing this? God. I don't know. I don't know why I'm doing this. I guess because I hate it when the bad guy gets away. That some people are above the law or think they are. I don't know. I guess that's part of it, but I guess I'd be lying if I say I'm feeling depressed, really depressed. And that's stupid because I'm not a family member. It's not one of my relatives that was killed in such a gruesome, brutal manner and then discarded. Like, so who am I to have these feelings? At the same time, I'm a human, you know? And I have a daughter and I have a son. I think my training as a writer is that I have a, I don't know, this sounds kind of stupid, but I have this, I feel more deeply about things than I think the average person does. Things, they sit with me, you know? And my imagination runs, and it's not always pleasant. And it's hard to turn that off. And when you're looking at basically a dumping ground of humans, two innocent young women, you can't not feel something. But what it is I feel, I can't pinpoint it. It's somewhere on the spectrum of despair, depression, sorrow, loss, helplessness, bordering on hopelessness. I don't know. I'm gonna come back here though. What I want to do is get some binoculars and look into the trees. Just an idea I have. I'm wondering if everybody was spending their time looking at the ground and they weren't looking up. I wonder if the killer had thrown something into the branches, a memento or something like that. All right, I gotta get out of here. So clearly, I was affected. And listen, I debated as to whether or not I should even put that recording into this episode, but I think it's important to stop and take a 30,000-foot view as to why these cases still matter, not just to the families, but to all of us. Because as the old saying goes, each of us dies twice, First, when our bodies expire, and second, when we are completely forgotten by the living. And these young people didn't deserve their first deaths, and they certainly don't deserve a second. And so I press on. By late April of 1984, law enforcement started to piece together a few things, and it's when they learned that Lance was in the Civic Theater, by his own admission, on that night of September 12th, that he began to materialize as a person of interest. Most notably, the cording found north of Kendrick with the bodies was consistent with cording used in the Civic Theater. The late Don Scheffler, then sergeant for the Lewiston Police Department, discussed this connection in the documentary Confluence. And again, if you haven't seen that documentary, you need to. There's a link to it on our website under articles and links.
You know, really, after a certain period of time, we didn't have a lot to go on. Once the bodies were located, about a year and a half afterwards, is where we started to really get involved more with the case. We did a lot of routine follow-up with the theater. The Civic Theater is definitely a crime scene because some of the evidence, which I can't say specifically what it was, which was found at the location where the two girls were recovered, was from the Civic Theater. We did a luminol test, which was to determine if there was any blood, you know, that was in the location of the basement by the back door. With a luminol test, it entails having a spray material that you spray in these areas, and then you use a black light type system that'll make everything glow if there is blood located. But the one false problem with this is that lead paint will cause the same reaction as blood stains, and the paint in the theater at that time was lead-based paint, so we couldn't determine if there was blood or the paint.
The Civic Theater was a crime scene. That's a declarative and important statement that shouldn't be overlooked. It was an official crime scene, and only one person was at the crime scene that night who had a vehicle and who was largely unaccounted for from around 9 p.m. on the night of September 12, 1982, until 5 to 5:30 the following morning. But as long as Stephen Pearsall remains missing, Lance, or anyone really, can always cast suspicion in his direction. So where is Stephen Pearsall? Where is Christina White, for that matter? I have a potential theory, or two potential theories. In early 1980, a consortium of governmental and private sector entities were resurrecting a 1962 proposal to build a 2.7 million kilowatt hydroelectric dam on the Snake River, upriver from Assotin. Known as the Assotin Dam Project, the initiative was a hot-button issue for recreationalists, environmentalists, conservationists, farmers, utility cooperatives, and anyone who had skin in that particular game. On April 17, 1980, just 11 days shy of the one-year anniversary of Christina White's disappearance, an article appeared in the Lewiston Morning Tribune with this headline, quote, "Assotin GOP Delegates Oppose Assotin Dam," end quote. The article lists the five delegates who were to travel to the Washington Republican Convention at Seattle that following June to specifically oppose the Assotin Dam project. What caught my eye, however, was that in the list of alternate delegates is our very own person of interest, Lance himself. His name caught my eye because it is unclear to me as to why, of all civic issues to throw his weight behind, why was he so keen on opposing the dam on the Snake River upstream from Assotin? He wasn't a recreationalist, we know, because he didn't have a boat, and as Clint had said, Lance didn't like the water, even though he was in the Navy. He wasn't an environmentalist or farmer, and he didn't have any connections to utility cooperatives or other private sector or governmental consortiums. So why the sudden interest in opposing a project on the Snake River upstream from Assotin? Why express the desire to travel to Seattle in June to formally lodge his and therefore Assotin's opposition to the project? Maybe it's because he was simply a concerned citizen who wanted to enter the political fray. Or maybe he was simply playing the role of the concerned citizen who wanted to enter the political fray, because any construction on the Snake River, especially construction involving a dam, could potentially unearth secrets he preferred not to be unearthed, like a 10-speed bicycle or the remains of a 12-year-old girl. that said, let me be clear. This is total conjecture on my part, and I will remind listeners once again that Lance has not been charged with any crimes related to these cases. And as I have said on this show before, in other scenarios of conjecture, taken in isolation, this seeming sudden interest in opposing the Assotin Dam project could be completely innocent. But if it were part of a pattern, then it might bear scrutiny. For instance, early in my investigation, I stumbled upon another article 12 years later in 1992 about a proposed drawdown of the Lower Granite Dam on the Snake River. The proposal was drafted by a number of agencies, including the Army Corps of Engineers, Bonneville Power Administration, the National Marine Fisheries Service, and the Bureau of Reclamation. They sought to study flow improvement for salmon. And while I won't get into the weeds on the study, just know that these agencies were calling to lower the level of Lower Granite Dam Reservoir by 28 feet. And, as it happens, one of the most vocal opponents to the proposal was, once again, our person of interest, Lance. On March 8, 1992, Lance wrote a letter to the editor of the Lewiston Morning Tribune decrying the entire proposal. He wrote, quote, "The Army Corps of Engineers' plan to save the supposedly endangered salmon brings up an inconsistency in the argument in favor of the drastic drawdown of our reservoir," end quote. He goes on to say, quote, "While we are being ordered to sacrifice so that more salmon reach the ocean, the people at the other end of the river are happily selling these fish by the boatload. This is not logical. If the situation is so desperate that we in this valley are expected to stop river shipping, lose the use of our boat ramps and recreational facilities, and risk physical damage to our property to ensure the survival of salmon, then all downstream fishing of salmon must stop. If, on the other hand, there are enough of these fish that a continued harvest of them is acceptable, then the drastic draining of our reservoir is simply an unjustifiable enrichment of fishing interests at our expense and must be stopped," end quote. And while I won't wade too far into the waters on this radically complex and politically fraught issue of dams on rivers in the American West, I will make a few observations on Lance's letter as it relates to those issues, and then on some of the language in his letter. First, I can speak with a modicum of authority on the issue of dams and rivers because when I was in graduate school, I worked for a private company that was hired by state and federal agencies to provide environmental audits and impact statements on proposed hydroelectric projects on rivers in the Pacific Northwest. And from my 4 years working with that firm, I can tell you that all stakeholders have to be accounted for and considered. All of them, in other words, especially indigenous tribes, have to have a seat at the table. I only mention this because Lance's all-or-nothing view on fishing for salmon is not only a false choice, wildly simplistic, but utterly myopic in view. In short, he is taking a radically complex, multi-year, multi-entity, multi-state proposal and is only looking at a small aspect of the entire project. Okay, so that aside, I want to call your attention to a word he uses twice. That word is drastic. In the first instance, he wrote, "the drastic drawdown of our reservoir." And in the second, he wrote, "the drastic draining of our reservoir." I keyed in on that word's double appearance because it could potentially be a tell. It could reveal some alarm in his thinking. I know, again, I could be way off base. But look at the case he attempts to make. He's talking about river shipping and boat docks and recreation and physical damage to property, absolutely none of which would have affected him in the least. So why the sudden interest? Why the alarm? Granted, his letter could be a one-off, right? A wild hair moved him to pen his opinion and mail it in. After all, he wrote letters to the editor on other matters, almost all of them one-offs, and I will get to those in a later episode. But with this issue, it wasn't a one-off. In a follow-up letter to the one I just quoted from above, Lance apologized for asserting that the proposal was the sole idea of the Army Corps of Engineers, when it was in fact the work of all the agencies I listed earlier. In his letter, he also mentioned a phone call he had had with someone from the Corps calling that person, quote, "foul-mouthed," end quote. And then, 2 years later, Lance was quoted in the Lewiston Morning Tribune again on the matter. He said, quote, "we see our lives floating away for a species you can buy in a can at the supermarket," end quote. And I have to say that this particular line has always raised my brow. Why? Well, a couple of reasons. First, in many of his letters, there is a subtext of death in his language, no matter the topic. And this one is an apt example. Our lives floating away. Second, it's way over the top. No one is going to die because of a drawdown. But perhaps his hyperbole, his exaggeration, could be read as a projection. Maybe Lance himself felt sufficiently threatened by the drawdown that he felt as though his life could slip away if something were to be found. But before you dismiss my speculation there outright, you should know that not only did Lance express his vehement opposition to the drawdown in the paper on at least three occasions, but my research also turned up something else rather interesting. Lance was evidently so invested in his opposition that he reached out to the agencies conducting the study and requested to be on their mailing list for the reports. In the back pages of the report titled Columbia and Snake River's 1992 Salmon Flow Measures for Idaho, Oregon, and Washington Options Analysis Document, we find his name in the distribution list. Likewise, in another report titled Lower Snake River Biological Drawdown Test Draft Environmental Impact Statement, we again find his name in the back pages under the distribution list. I mention these documents for a couple of reasons. Only a handful of people in the world actually read these. I know because I've helped prepare these kinds of documents. Those people are almost exclusively agency heads, tribal leaders, utility leaders, scientists, and congressional aides assigned to that kind of lobbying portfolio. Literally no one else reads these because they amount to a doctoral dissertation written in jargon that only a handful of people can fully metabolize anyway. So again, I pose the question, why was Lance receiving these reports? Why did he have that kind of heightened interest? And it turns out that I wasn't the only one who thought his opposition to the drawdown was suspicious. I have a confidential source who is very close to these cases who messaged me a few weeks ago stating that he had also alerted authorities of Lance's strange preoccupation with the drawdown. So it's a question I posed to Detective Jackie Nichols just to get her take. So one thing that I thought was interesting, and you probably already know about this because you guys are the experts and I'm just a storyteller, is that in 1994, there was a proposal done by a government agency to draw down Lower Granite Dam for salmon study, and it became a hot button issue politically. It was interesting because Lance became very involved and vocal opposing the drawdown of Lower Granite Reservoir. And he's in the paper quoted as being opposed to it. And, you know, I found his name at the back of one of the environmental impact statement reports. So he was receiving reports from the agencies conducting the study to do the drawdown and being vocal about it in the papers. And I just thought that was really interesting. And I'm wondering if there's ever been a search of Lower Granite Dam Reservoir.
That brings a couple of things to mind. He did involve himself in kind of local politics on various issues and was sort of a regular writer of letters to the editor about different topics. So I don't think it's a huge red flag that he was involved in that. But I do think that, you know, if you had hidden something in that reservoir and you didn't want it to be found, you would definitely be opposed to the drawdown. So I agree with that being suspicious. The reservoir itself is enormous, and I've done a lot of work since we've had lots of, you know, we've had bodies go into the river, that we know of, and accidental drownings, vehicles going into the water, boat accidents over the years has, I guess, allowed me to have a lot of personal experience with the river and the reservoir and the currents. And also we had a homicide case from around 2010, in which the suspects reportedly had thrown the body into the river. And so we spent a lot of time with underwater sonar looking for that body. And the U.S. Coast Guard came out and helped us with one of their little robots. During that time, of course, we had a couple other missing people. So I was obviously also looking for Christina White, bicycles, things that could be linked to other missing persons. The nature of that waterway makes it very, very difficult to search. The current is extremely strong underwater. It's very deep. Under the bridges and things, there's huge, huge boulders with deep crevasses. So it would be hard to say that it was ever thoroughly searched, but I think it's all been searched as much as we can possibly do it with today's technology.
A couple of things stand out to me. One is that Jackie does keep the option open of his behavior being suspicious. Again, in isolation, his piqued interest might not mean anything. But he was opposed to the Asotin Dam, which would have been constructed in the reach of the Snake River, where Addie Alderman claims to have seen Christina White's body. Then, Lance fixated on the proposed drawdown of Lower Granite Dam Reservoir. And if he was sweating either of these projects, you should know that he dodged both of those proverbial bullets. The dam project never materialized and the drawdown never happened. Circling back to what is one of the key mysteries in all these cases, the whereabouts of Stephen Pearsall, I began looking at a map and the location of where the remains of Christina and Brandy were found. The distance from the Civic Theater to that location is roughly 25 miles as the crow flies. I drove that route the other day and it took me about 36 minutes. The current speed limit for that route is 65 miles per hour. So most people drive it at about 70. In 1982, however, the speed limit was still 55, so that's the speed I drove. On my Google map, I drew a straight line from the Civic Theater to the location where the girls' remains were found. It's a line that runs at about a 45-degree angle northeast. Curious, I drew a straight line from the Civic Theater at about 45 degrees northwest for the same distance of about 25 miles. And where did that leave me? You guessed it, Lower Granite Dam Reservoir. It's almost a perfect triangle with Lewiston Civic Theater serving as the bottom point of the triangle. You can see an image of this triangulation on our website, snakeriverkiller.com, under Resources Maps. Anecdotally, Lower Granite Dam is just 2 miles up from the location of where the remains of a WSU student named Joyce LePage were found wrapped in an army blanket and rug. She vanished from Stevens Hall in the WSU campus in the summer of 1971 and wasn't found until April of 1972. Many suspect she may have been a victim of Ted Bundy. And to be clear, there is no connection between her murder and the cases linked to Lance, because he was still in California at the time. But her case was and still is well known in the LC Valley and in the Moscow Pullman communities, and has been revived by some in light of the Moscow murders and the recent arrest of Brian Koberger. In other words, if a serial killer had known about the location of her remains and had, say, quote, admired the heinous crimes of Ted Bundy, then such a person might be drawn to that location for his own crime. And as I have said all along in these cases, the geography matters. If someone disposed of the girls in Idaho and Stephen Pearsall in Washington, where Lower Granite Dam Reservoir would be, not only would it create jurisdictional problems, but so long as Stephen Pearsall was never found, he again could be pointed to as a suspect. Again, this is all theory, but Lance's preoccupation with what he twice called a drastic draining of the reservoir makes me wonder, and it should make you wonder too. The Snake River Killer is a production of Resuscitate Media, LLC. I'm the host, Brandon Schrand. Original music is written and performed by the Young Night Drifters. Special thanks to Blake Walker, our engineer. Associate producers and investigators Gloria Boberts and Paul Dale. Graphic designer and content contributor Samantha Sawyer. Research consultant and criminologist Dr. Marianne White. And research assistant Tina Landry Oddie. Special thanks to Jennifer Anderson and Vernon Lott for letting us air portions of their documentary, Confluence. Be sure to check us out online where you can subscribe to the show and find resources, photos, timelines, articles, links, and more. Next time on The Snake River Killer. On the morning of August 3rd, 1963, the body of an 8-year-old girl named Diane Taylor was found in an alley in Chicago's Austin neighborhood. She had been strangled, bludgeoned, stabbed, and raped. She was last seen at her neighborhood's YMCA, where Lance, who was 15 at the time, served as her youth counselor.
Having multiple methods, we don't see that in most cases. We'll see it was a stabbing or it was a shooting, but since we saw such brutality here with beating and strangling and stabbing, and it seems like it was to the point of overkill, it makes me wonder if it was somebody who was pretty inexperienced. I wonder if he used multiple methods to get a feel for things and see what he liked and what worked for him.
I used to go to the park after school playing softball, and the teacher was female. And when I would go there, I would hang around her, a coach, a counselor, because right. I had the fear in me. I was like It was dark. I'm going home because I was afraid that was gonna happen to me. They told me the thought was that their YMCA counselor did it, but they couldn't prove it.
And people don't want to get involved either. I did have somebody message me, and her mother had dated Lance. And that's about as far as you just don't get people to talk.